From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Melissa Block. At age 67, Herda Saunders has written a memoir, A View into Her Life with Early Onset Dementia.
What does it mean to live with an identity that's eroding all the time? I felt a strong feeling to understand this disease before the time when I couldn't understand anything anymore.
Memory's Last Breath, later this hour. Also, President Trump and the special counsel's investigation. We'll ask a former U.S. commander in Afghanistan if sending more troops there will change the balance on the battlefield. And we'll go out fishing in Alaska, where life lessons are passed from father to daughter on the sea. First, our newscast. It's Saturday, June 17th, 2017.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. A U.S. Navy destroyer is back at its Japanese base, but seven sailors remain missing following a collision with a Philippine container ship off Japan's coast. From Tokyo, John Matthews reports a USS Fitzgerald managed to stabilize flooding with help from another U.S. ship.
Navy officials at the 7th Fleet, which is based out of Japan, say the USS Dewey is assisting with damage control efforts on the Fitzgerald. Both are missile destroyers with complements of about 280 and 380 personnel, respectively. It's still unclear as to how the Fitzgerald managed to collide with the container ship, which has around 2.5 times the tonnage of the U.S. boat. Weather conditions were fine, although sea lanes were fairly busy around 2:30 a.m. when the collision originally happened. Japanese Coast Guard personnel are also on site, helping with damage control and search and rescue. Two of the crew, as well as the ship's commander, are currently receiving treatment at a U.S. naval hospital on shore. For NPR News, I'm John Matthews in Tokyo.
A destroyer that helped stabilize the Fitzgerald has now joined other American and Japanese vessels and aircraft in the search for the missing sailors. Minnesota, Ramsey County Attorney John Choi says he's disappointed in the jury's decision to acquit the police officer charged in the death of black motorist Philando Castile last summer.
I can't even imagine what this must feel like for the family of Philando Castile, his friends, and all those that loved him, and also for Diamond Reynolds. I'm just really sad for them. And I really believe that as a community, we should pray for them.
Following the acquittal of Officer Geronimo Yanez, thousands of protesters took to the streets of St. Paul. The demonstration largely peaceful. However, light rail service was disrupted, and some protesters blocked part of an interstate. A statement from the city of St. Anthony says Officer Yanez will not return to active duty, saying the public will be best served if he no longer works for the city. Jury deliberations resumed today in the sexual assault trial of Bill Cosby near Philadelphia. Bobby Allen of member station WHYY reports that the judge has denied several requests to declare a mistrial.
The mostly white jury of 7 men and 5 women have asked more than a dozen questions since they started deliberating Monday. That has meant they have heard most of the key evidence in the case twice. Still, they remain locked in a standoff over whether to believe the story of accuser Andrea Constan. Cosby spokesman Andrew Wyatt suggested that a mistrial caused by jurors not reaching a consensus would be a victory.
And hopefully they will make a decision. If they don't make a decision, hopefully they'll call it a deadlock.
The judge has said that there is no deliberation time limit, saying jurors should keep working toward a verdict. For NPR News, I'm Bobby Allen in Norristown.
And you're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. More than 50 vessels from around the world are preparing to sail into Boston Harbor. Today's grand parade of sail is the main event of Sail Boston 2017. Spectators will jam areas around the harbor. The MBTA's Jeff Gonville says the T is ready to get crowds in and out of the city.
So this is peak weekday service levels. On our Silver Line, we are actually going to be running greater levels of service than we do on a typical weekday. And we are going to be adding additional commuter rail trains.
Loc Tran is part of the crew aboard the U.S. Coast Guard's tall ship, the Eagle. He grew up in Dorchester and Braintree and says he's excited to be on the ship that's leading the parade.
It's cool to be able to be in front of the parade for Sail Boston. I get to see all my friends and family.
Security for the event is tight. 13 people are recovering from injuries after the high-speed ferry they were on crashed into a jetty as it entered Hyannis Harbor last night. The Steamship Authority believes choppy seas and strong winds contributed to the crash of its vessel. Hyannis Fire Chief Dean Melanson says none of the injuries are life-threatening.
We had, one person who fell down a stairwell and had a head injury and had been knocked unconscious for a period of time. We had a number of bumps and bruises, strains, and asthma attack.
He says 57 people had been on board and some were lifted off the ferry by a Coast Guard helicopter. The ferry was making its last trip of the day from Nantucket. In sports, last night the Red Sox beat the Astros 2-1. They play again tonight in Houston, and tonight at Gillette, the Revs host the Chicago Fire. In the forecast for the Boston area, clouds around today, some fog, scattered showers, thunderstorms possible, highs today in the low 70s. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the law firm of Nutter, McLennan & Fish, counsel to leading companies and institutions for more than a century. Client-focused, collaborative, this is Nutter, online at Nutter.com. Innuendo, now featuring Hunter Douglas shades for light and glare control and hard-to-reach windows. Hunter Douglas at Innuendo, Route 9 Natick and Innuendo.com. And Whole Foods Market, offering brews, grooming products, and Father's Day meal ingredients. Recipes with a Father's Day theme are available at WholeFoodsMarket.com. Whole Foods Market, we believe in real food.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Scott Simon is away. Over the past few days, President Trump announced some consequential policy decisions. Yesterday, he rolled back openings for trade and travel with Cuba that the Obama administration had introduced. On Thursday, the administration said that protections for some immigrants who entered the country illegally as children, the so-called Dreamers, will remain in place. And yet, the president could not hold back from lashing out at the latest developments in the Russia investigation, including reporting by the Washington Post that Trump himself is under investigation for possible obstruction of justice. NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro has been following, among many other things, the presidential tweets, and he joins us now. Good morning, Domenico.
Good morning, Melissa.
And once again, we are finding ourselves talking about the president's tweets. Here's one from yesterday morning. He wrote this: I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director, witch hunt. And that sure sounds, Domenico, like he's acknowledging that he is, in fact, under investigation.
Yeah, well, but a source from Trump's legal team actually tells us that he did not learn this from authorities. It was referring to the Washington Post report, so he seemed to be stewing over it and decided to tweet about it the next morning. But remember, it's not outside the realm of possibility, obviously. He had asked James Comey when he was FBI director if he was under investigation some three times. So, you know, we thought maybe that could be possible, of course. But as far as we know, it's a reaction to news reports, as his legal team told us. He appears also, though, to be taking a shot at Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, because Rosenstein is the person who recommended Comey's firing, you might remember, and whose memo the White House initially said that they'd base the firing on. Of course, Trump undermined that rationale when he went on TV and said that he was thinking of the Russia investigation, and he fired Comey regardless of recommendation.
There was a lot of reporting this week about the scope of the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Where does that probe seem to stand at this point?
Well, you know, I think it's a little different than what you'd seen under James Comey, because Robert Mueller is not exactly the kind of person who likes to have a high profile. He's a low profile guy. So you likely won't hear much from him or the FBI on this as the investigation moves forward. Rosenstein testified last week that he has seen no cause for dismissing Mueller at this point, and he would not dismiss him if someone pressured him, read the president. But Rosenstein is also facing pressure from the White House to crack down on those leaks. The White House is really annoyed with all of the leaks that have been coming out of the intelligence community. And that might explain Rosenstein's kind of odd statement Thursday night about not believing anonymous leaks, which came after that Washington Post report.
Not believing anonymous leaks, particularly when they do not identify the country, which had a lot of people scratching their heads.
Yeah.
Domenico, heading into next week, we're looking for more congressional hearings. There's going to be focus on the security of voting systems and how to prevent Russian hacking in the future. What might we learn there?
Well, there's a couple of hearings next week. Tuesday, there's one before the Senate Judiciary Committee about lessons from history and how to carry out what's called concurrent investigations. In other words, how a congressional investigation would not interfere with a Justice Department investigation and vice versa. Wednesday, though, is going to be a pretty big day. Former head of Homeland Security for President Obama, Jay Johnson, is going to testify before the House Intelligence Committee. At the same time, the Senate Intelligence Committee is going to be interviewing DHS and FBI officials and outside experts. It's also possible that acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe is going to make an appearance before the Budget Committee to talk about his budget, and we know that's going to probably talk about Russia, too.
Okay. NPR's Domenico Montanaro following all this for us. Thanks so much, Domenico.
All right. Thank you.
Additional U.S. troops are likely headed for Afghanistan. A U.S. official confirms to NPR that the Pentagon is expected to send nearly 4,000 more troops to train Afghan security forces. They will join the 8,000 to 10,000 U.S. troops who are currently there. But after 16 years of fighting, the Taliban continues to gain territory and mount brazen attacks. So if the Taliban couldn't be defeated with the 100,000 U.S. troops that used to be in Afghanistan, how will a couple of thousand more change the equation? For some perspective, we turn now to retired Lieutenant General David Barno. He was the overall commander in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005. He's currently at the School of International Service at American University here in Washington. General Barno, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
We heard the Defense Secretary James Mattis tell Congress this week that the U.S. is not winning, his words, in Afghanistan. Do you think these additional 4,000 troops could actually make a difference there?
Well, I think they'll help fill in some of the gaps that the U.S. commander there, General John Nicholson, talked about in his testimony earlier this year. He needs some more forces to be able to get out with Afghan units as advisors. He needs some more forces to do the counterterrorism mission against a Islamic State force there that's growing in strength. And so it's simply going to be a gap filler in many respects. I don't think it's going to be some type of a decisive increment of troops that all of a sudden is going to turn around the battlefield results and make this a war that we're suddenly winning when those troops get deployed.
And does it strike you, though, that in trying to come up with a new strategy, there are really any more options than have been on the table in past administrations who have been trying hard and much blood and treasure has been spilled in trying to answer these very same questions for many, many years now?
I think there's some potential different openings here. You've got a very different president with a very different outlook about American commitments around the world. I think he is going to consider all options, including a zero option potentially for Afghanistan.
A zero option, meaning
which means
what, no
U.S. troops, yeah.
Well, wait a minute. If they're talking about a zero option of no U.S. troops, what would the point be of sending 4,000 additional troops as they're talking about doing now?
Well, again, I don't think this idea of no U.S. troops is a principal option, but I think they are going to consider a range that takes them from, you know, no U.S. troops in Afghanistan to one that has, you know, somewhat of a buildup of troops that can put more pressure on the Taliban, ideally to get them to the negotiating table. So I think this will be a wide-ranging strategy review. Every previous strategy review has actually considered that as an option as well.
General Barno, I feel like I've had similar conversations over the past 12 or so years about U.S. strategy in Afghanistan and the need to build up the Afghan army so it can stand on its own. There's a Groundhog Day feeling to all of this. I mean, are you at all confident that anything could be different that would shift the equation and alter the U.S. role in Afghanistan in a positive way?
I think these additional troops are going to be able to be pushed further forward as advisors with frontline Afghan units. That has been prohibited under the Obama administration. They haven't been out there on the battlefield. If you connect the forward-based advisors that are out with Afghan units to some additional air power that can actually direct some serious firepower against some of these Afghan formations, that might deliver a little bit of a different result. We've been actually pretty constrained given the numbers of forces that we've had in Afghanistan for the last 2 years at least, and the rules of engagement and the ability to be able to get them forward onto the battlefield where they can actually have an impact.
Think back, if you would, General Barno, to when you were the U.S. commander in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005. Would you have imagined at the time that this war would still be going on some 12 years later and that the U.S. would still be involved?
No, I wouldn't. Certainly would not have envisioned that the Taliban would have resurged so strongly and have, you know, so much territory and things were looking much different, much better than they are today. So it is a bit disconcerting, and most concerning, I think, is that we haven't really found the right path to take us to where we want to get. And I'm not sure we clearly are articulating to ourselves what success for us, what's the acceptable outcome here for the United States, and how do we get to that, and is there any way to get to that?
That's retired Lieutenant General David Barno with American University's School of International Service. General Barno, thanks for speaking with us.
Yep, you're very welcome.
It all started with vellum. We were led to believe that Queen Elizabeth's speech opening a new session of the British Parliament next week was being delayed because it had to be printed on vellum, a parchment made from the skin of a calf, and that ink on vellum takes quite a while to dry, hence the delay. Fascinating. So British. Well, it turns out the Queen's speech used to be inked on vellum, but those days are long gone. Now it's printed on goatskin parchment. But don't be fooled, there is no actual goatskin in the Queen's goatskin. Stay with me here. Next week, when she addresses Parliament, the Queen will be holding thick archival parchment, which is called goatskin, but which does not contain animal hide. And apparently, the ink on this goatskin will take several days to dry. But apart from the problem of the extended drying time, the speech is being delayed for political reasons, too. The Queen's speech at the state opening of Parliament lays out the government's agenda for the next session. And as you might imagine, that agenda is a bit up in the air, since the Conservative Party failed to hold on to its majority in Parliament and is scrambling to build a coalition. So, delays. And what a crushing disappointment to learn that this year the Queen will be dressing down for her speech, wearing just a day dress and hat, not the royal robes. And there will be reduced ceremonial elements, which is a real shame. Because in most years, the Queen's speech to Parliament is a full-on royal spectacle, full of pomp and wonder. Here's how it usually goes. The Queen delivers her speech, also known as the Gracious Address, seated in the chamber of the House of Lords on the throne. On her head, the imperial state crown, which is delivered to Westminster in its own horse-drawn carriage. Its cap is purple velvet, perched on a frame larded with thousands of precious gems. It weighs more than 2 pounds. Poor Queen. And there's so much more. There's the cap of maintenance, the great sword of state, and the gentleman usher of the black rod. And then there's the speech, not written by the Queen herself, but she reads it dutifully. Truth be told, the speech itself is usually a bit of a snooze, a pro forma government blueprint. But the pageantry, now that is worth waiting for. And apparently we'll have to wait until 2018 for all that, because this year the Queen is dressing down.
Hello, I'm writer David McCullough, here to remind you that you can listen to WBUR on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM.
It is 60 degrees in Boston at 8:18. Coming up on Weekend Edition Saturday, a conversation with a crew member on board the U.S. Coast Guard's tall ship, the Eagle, getting ready for this morning's Grand Parade of Sail, the signature event of Sail Boston 2017. In the forecast for the Boston area, cloudy, some areas of fog, scattered showers, thunderstorms possible this afternoon, highs today in the low 70s. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fidelity Investments, reminding you it's never too early to start saving for your child's future. Learn more about a tax-advantaged 529 college savings account and how you can use the money to pay for qualified expenses at fidelity.com/ufund. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE SIPC. And GE, from 3D printing orthopedic and dental implants to building models of hearts and livers. GEadditive.com, working to change the future of healthcare.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Searchers are still looking for seven missing crew members from the U.S. Navy destroyer USS Fitzgerald. The Fitzgerald collided with a merchant vessel off Japan. At least three other sailors were injured, including the captain. The Cuban government is denouncing President Trump's speech in Miami yesterday, in which he laid out his new Cuba policy. But in a statement released last night, Cuban President Raul Castro's administration said Cuba remains willing to engage in what it called respectful dialogue. And President Trump is leaving the White House this morning for a weekend at Camp David, the presidential retreat in the Maryland Mountains. A visit there will be Trump's first as president. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ProQuest, partners with the USC Shoah Foundation to enable access to the Visual History Archive for helping students and researchers understand the impact of genocide through video interviews with survivors. Learn more at ProQuest.com. And from Tate's Bake Shop, whose founder, Kathleen King, started selling her handmade chocolate chip cookies from her dad's farm stand in the Hamptons as a child. Now at markets nationwide. Gift baskets are at tatesbakeshop.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block. The Trump administration has found an issue that infuriates both Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill, a move that would limit Congress's ability to monitor the executive branch. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The Justice Department says the Constitution doesn't give individual members of Congress the power to do oversight, that is, to investigate how well executive branch agencies do their jobs. Under this new policy, when your local representative writes a letter asking questions about some problem, the agency most likely blows it off.
Everything that every eighth grade student has studied about checks and balances of government.
Senator Charles Grassley, an Iowa Republican, said the policy disregards the Constitution.
It eliminates the check of most members of Congress to see that the laws are faithfully executed by a president.
Grassley is chairman of the powerful Judiciary Committee, and he's also done plenty of oversight investigations on his own. He said the Trump administration should abandon the new policy. And if it won't?
If they don't want to eliminate it, then, you know, Congress can legislate in that area.
An administration spokesperson told NPR the White House looks forward to reaching a mutual understanding with Grassley, but the legal opinion fully and accurately states the law. The policy can sound pretty innocuous. Timothy Horn, acting administrator of the Federal General Services Administration, explained it to a House committee last month.
The administration has instituted a new policy that matters of oversight need to be requested by the committee chair.
Translation?
The Justice Department said they should treat individual members of Congress requests for information as Freedom of Information Act requests, like anyone in the public can send in. So this is a bit of a subtle change, but it's important.
That's Nick Schwellenbach. He's with the nonprofit Project on Government Oversight. But not all agency heads are taking as hard a line as the Justice Department. Here's Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly at another recent hearing.
Regardless of who the letter comes from, and it doesn't have to just come from a ranking member or chairman, we'll respond to any congressional inquiry.
Still, Maryland Congressman John Sarbanes said House Democrats have seen almost all of their letters get ignored by the Trump administration, a contrast to last year's campaign rhetoric.
They've certainly put an emphasis with this idea of draining the swamp on accountability and transparency, but so far they seem to moved in the complete opposite direction.
It's possible the administration policy will run into the bipartisan institutional loyalties on Capitol Hill, as Rhode Island Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse pointed out.
The idea that the legislative branch would willingly go along with this kind of an assault on its powers by the executive branch runs contrary to the interests of every senator.
Provided, of course, that the senators and representatives can agree to do something about it. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The land border crossing between Tijuana, Mexico, and San Ysidro, California, is the busiest in the world. As Jonathan Levinson reports, among the crowd are students whose families live in Tijuana and who commute each morning to bring their children to school in the United States.
Juan and his mom, Maria, wake up at 5:30 every morning to make the trek from their home in Tijuana to high school in San Ysidro. They have to get up early because crossing the border can take up to an hour and a half on some mornings.
It's been kind of a lot. Every day just crossing, it's like the time management, it's finishing homework on time. Yeah, it's a lot.
But Juan's mom says it's worth the sacrifice.
Aquí tiene más futuro en Estados Unidos, él de hecho es de acá.
He has more of a future here in the United States. The school is much better here than in Tijuana. It's a lot of work, a lot for him and for me. We wake up very early, wait in line, but it's worth it.
They ask not to be identified by their last name because families caught living outside the district can be fined the cost of their education. Teachers in San Ysidro say as many as 1,000 students cross the border every morning to go to school. I joined them on a recent morning to see what it's like. It's 5:30 in the morning, and I'm standing here in Tijuana on the Mexico side of the border, and there's a steady stream of cars pulling up, dropping off kids who are all making their way through the fence, up the ramp to cross the border into the United States to go to school. There are kids of all ages, high school students coming in groups of 3, 4, and 5. There are younger kids walking with their parents. One boy just came by riding on his dad's shoulders with his sister walking alongside of him. On the other side, some students get on the bus while others take off on skateboards and bikes. But many of the younger ones will walk just a few blocks to Willow Elementary School, where Nancy Alvarado has taught fifth grade since 2000.
In many cases, those are the kids who are here every day with their little backpack on and their hair combed and their breakfast eaten. And they get up at the crack of dawn. And any parent that's willing to make that sacrifice obviously wants their children in school.
Alvarado says there are two primary reasons families move to Tijuana. One is the cost of living in Southern California. The other is when parents of kids who are U.S. citizens find themselves forcibly removed from the United States, many still want their children to have a U.S. education.
We have kids arrive mid-year because somebody got deported, and that's every year. You get some kid that arrives in, you know, April, and it's like, oh, so where were you before this? Oh, Bakersfield. And what brings you to San Ysidro? Ah, my dad was deported. That's every single year.
All but one of Alvarado's 30 students are Hispanic, and many commute from Mexico.
Good morning.
As class begins, Alvarado tells me she sees that her students are visibly stressed by having to cross the border every day, especially now with heightened rhetoric about illegal immigration.
They hear this, the rhetoric of build the wall, and they imagined the Berlin Wall. My kids are very aware of all that.
Public school budgets are determined by attendance and funded through property taxes. In order to enroll, families must prove residency. No one from the school district responded to efforts seeking comment on whether families of kids traveling daily from Tijuana were skirting the rules. But the executive director of the San Ysidro Chamber of Commerce said the community had faith in the system.
As a community, we trust in our school district and what they do as far as their residency confirmation.
That's Jason Wells.
I wouldn't say that the community sees children coming from Mexico as a tax burden. Like I said, this community is very supportive to people regardless of their immigration status.
Maria and her son still lived in the district last year when she registered him for school.
We lived here in San Diego, but here the rent is very expensive. So I decided to go to Tijuana.
But before next year, they will have to find another way to prove residency.
I'm scared. Next year they'll ask for a lot of papers. I'll ask for an address from one of my family members. I'll ask for a favor and maybe he'll stay here with them. It'll be harder for me because we're used to being together. But, well, he has to.
Nancy Alvarado, the fifth grade teacher, is quick to point out that most of the families who cross the border would likely be homeless if they stayed in San Ysidro and wouldn't be paying property taxes anyway. Besides, she says,
those kids are American citizens. They have a right to live here. That they don't live here now doesn't mean they won't live here someday.
That being the case, she says it's in the community's and the nation's best interest to see them educated. For NPR News, I'm Jonathan Levinson in San Ysidro.
In southeast Alaska, the commercial king salmon fishing season was temporarily shut down this spring. That's because the numbers of wild salmon returning to spawn are at an all-time low. And that's worrisome news for those who make their living on the sea. I was on a reporting trip in southeast Alaska before the fishery closed, and I went out with a father and daughter trolling team in search of salmon.
Come on, make yourself at home.
Come on board the Alexa K.
Yeah, hi, Don. Charlie on the Alexa K.
a 45-foot steel-hulled troller.
I wondered if we could come over and get a little splash of ice.
We're setting out from the harbor in Sitka in southeast Alaska with Charlie Wilbur and his daughter, Adrienne.
Oh, there's a sea lion. See its nose coming up right there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That sea lion's got the same mission we do. We're both looking for salmon. But first, we need that ice to chill the catch. It gets sprayed down from the dock in a giant tube, enough for two big coolers.
Thank you.
And off we go, out into Sitka Sound.
We're heading out into the briny deep.
Charlie Wilbur is 69 now. He's been fishing these waters for nearly 40 years.
I was raised in Omaha, Nebraska.
You were not a seafaring people in your family.
Not at all. No. I never would have imagined I'd end up doing this.
Charlie came to Alaska fresh out of college, had a job fighting fires as a smoke jumper, went out fishing with a friend, and got the bug, as he puts it.
They were just twisted, Dad. It's fine.
Daughter Adrienne is 27. She's been fishing with her dad since she was about 11. And a lot of the qualities she values most, she learned right here on this boat.
Persistence and having good attitude and optimism. Living closely with one other person that you're not always getting along with, but still having to work with in a productive way.
Mm-hmm.
Those skills I use every day.
All right, it's time to fish.
Okay, Adri, let's put them out.
Charlie and Adrienne lower the trolling poles, one on each side of the boat, and get busy hooking artificial lures to the lines.
So it's the lead spoon on the bottom, three flashers.
As they work, a trail of colorful gear spools off behind the boat, a smorgasbord of temptation for fussy fish. It's the first time this spring the Wilbers have been out on the Alexakay.
We're fishing! Let's start catching!
Father and daughter work in tandem, an instinctive, easy rhythm, born of years spent together on this boat.
I remember when I was first learning how to fish, having to go really slow and getting my gear tangled up, and then Dad would have to come fix it, and oh no, I've messed up. But it feels so good to be out here today. Just that motion of hauling the gear and setting the gear.
Over several hours, the Wilbers reel the gear in and send it back out, time after time. But today,
I gotta say, the water's looking pretty blank, Adri.
The fish just aren't biting, so we have to take Adrienne's word for it.
The fish are beautiful when they come out of the water. The king salmon especially have these really dark black mouths and then silver sides and white bellies and dark tops. But in that sort of darkness is also like these shimmers of gold and shimmers of lavender, and
lavender
spots.
Color. They are gorgeous fish.
Yeah, just very, very beautiful.
It's clear the Wilbers take real pride in the quality and sustainability of their wild catch. Alaska fishermen operate under a quota system that limits the harvest. But lately, the trends are alarming, with low king salmon numbers forcing the early closure of the fishery this spring. Some salmon biologists point to warming ocean temperatures as the main reason behind the decline. And out on the water, Charlie Wilbur says it's clear. Things are changing.
The water temperatures are warmer. We've seen species of fish that don't ordinarily get up this far. I mean, we've seen sunfish, we've seen turtles, we've seen some pomfret.
And there's been a bunch of squid that have come in the last 2 years, right?
Yeah. It's really hard to pin it down to say this is climate change, but things are definitely changing. So, Adrian, I think we need to go out and
run through
our lines here.
Still no fish. Maybe that sea lion got him before we did. So the Wilbers lower the poles and head back to port.
We were skunked.
Next trip, Dad. Next trip.
It's Adrienne and Charlie Wilbur on the Alexakay out of Sitka, Alaska.
All right, we survived another one. Everybody came home.
Father's Day is tomorrow, a time to celebrate dads for their devotion, their love, and They're really bad jokes. Tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday, NPR's Netta Ulaby will deconstruct just what makes a dad joke. But we wanted to get a head start on the Father's Day celebrations, so we asked for your best examples of the form, and you came through with some winners, or should we say, groaners.
Why can't you tell jokes to a kleptomaniac? Because they take things literally.
I told my doctor that I always get heartburn when I eat birthday cake. He said that I should try to remember to take the candles off first.
We'd usually be hit with it when we were in the car. Dad would say, "They're looking for you." And the obvious question would be, "Who?" And he'd always say, "The squirrels. They think you're nuts." Completely deadpan.
Oof. Dad joke submitted to us from Kelly Walker, Kenny Lappins, and Michael Gundlach. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR's Weekend Edition Saturday. I'm Sharon Brody. The signature event of Sail Boston 2017 is getting underway this morning. 56 vessels from around the world will sail into Boston Harbor. Large crowds are expected to jam the harbor front to watch the tall ships in the grand parade of sail. And, of course, crew members will have something of a reverse perspective, getting quite the view of the city and of some 2 million people expected to turn out for the 5 days of Sail Boston. Luc Tran is a crew member from Boston aboard the U.S. Coast Guard's tall ship, the Eagle, and he joins us now from aboard the vessel as it prepares for the Grand Parade. Luc, good morning.
Good morning.
As you look out this morning, tell us where you are and what you're seeing.
So we're right outside of the Boston Harbor. There's a lot of fog out. It's a little hard to see, but so far, so good. And there's a lot of tall ships around us right now.
What needs to be done to get the ship ready for sail?
It takes a lot of teamwork. We need everyone manned and ready for all situations. Everything needs to be on pace, on time.
What are your specific duties?
I am in the operations department and specifically in navigation. So I do all the charting and I train for navigation fundamentals and whatnot.
What are the challenges you're finding of navigating here in Boston?
So Boston Harbor has a lot of narrow channels. It's a lot shorter than most channels. A lot of small pieces of land and islands all surrounding the area. There's a lot of traffic. We've done this multiple times, so I feel that we are pretty comfortable in navigating through from here to the Charlestown Pier.
So, okay, you're a Boston and Boston area guy. What does this event mean to you?
It's pretty special. Very excited. It's my first time being on the Coast Guard Carrier Eagle, coming back to Boston. It's cool to be able to be in front of the parade for Sail Boston. I get to see all my friends and family.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
No problem.
Luc Tran from Boston is aboard the U.S. Coast Guard's tall ship, the Eagle. The Eagle is the seventh U.S. Coast Guard cutter to bear the name, built in 1936. It originally was operated by Nazi Germany to train cadets for the German Navy. The U.S. took the ship as a war prize after World War II. And Sail Boston has just announced that fog is going to delay the start of this morning's parade. It will now start not at 9 a.m. It will start at 10 this morning. WBUR's meteorologist David Epstein talks about the conditions in general for the Sail Boston crowds.
I can't rule out a shower, but mostly it should be dry. Just plan on some humidity. Bring the sunscreen. Even though you don't see the sun, the UV rays can still get through all these clouds, and temperatures will be in the low to mid-70s.
Today, the MBTA is running subway trains as frequently as it does during weekday rush hours. Extra trains are running on the commuter rail. Many streets and neighborhoods leading to the harbor are closed to traffic. Another major story this morning, an investigation is underway as 13 people recover from injuries after the high-speed ferry they were on crashed into a jetty as it entered Hyannis Harbor last night. The Steamship Authority says bad weather contributed to the crash. Hyannis Fire Chief Dean Melanson says winds and 4 to 5 foot seas also hampered efforts to remove the 56 people on board the craft.
We actually had a couple rescue boats that had to return. They were unable to transit because offshore the wave height was even higher.
The ferry was making its last trip of the day from Nantucket. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Welch and Forbes, customized investment portfolios, private trustees, and family office services since 1838. WelchForbes.com. Brandeis University with the Adventures in Creative Retirement Conference, September 9th. Imagine your future. Register at brandeis.edu/adventures. And the Harvard Art Museums, featuring 4 new exhibitions as well as new works from the collections. On view now. harvardartmuseums.org.
Taking a look at sports, last night the Red Sox beat the Astros 2-1. They play again tonight in Houston. Rick Porcello gets the start for Boston. And tonight in Foxborough, the Revs host the Chicago Fire. This is 90.9 WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ron Suskind.
And I'm Heather Cox Richardson.
We're the hosts of Freak Out and Carry On, the new politics and history podcast that asks, what is happening? And has it happened before?
Ron is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with decades of experience in Washington.
And Heather is a noted historian with a unique view of the Trump administration.
Join us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to Freak Out and Carry On.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life at gatesfoundation.org. From C3 IoT, providing a software platform that brings machine learning, big data, and cloud computing to industrial-scale predictive analytics and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Since the presidential election, George Orwell's 1984 has become a bestseller again. The dystopian novel in which the main character works at the Ministry of Truth, creating fake news for a totalitarian regime, has been adapted for the stage, and it's opening on Broadway next week. Jeff London reports.
All of the ideas are in the play. Ignorance is strength. War is peace. Freedom is slavery. Big Brother is watching. After a recent performance, I spoke with a pair of doctors from Great Neck, New York. Alvin and Dorit Friedman. They said they were struck by how contemporary the 1949 story feels.
Big Brother is watching us, that's for sure.
The most quoted phrase ever, Big Brother is watching.
Right. Little did we know that that was going to be reality.
Facebook and Amazon know what you like. George Orwell wrote his novel in reaction to the fascism and totalitarianism that had engulfed the globe during and after the Second World War. The novel has always been a steady seller, says Bruce Nichols, the book's current publisher at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
1984 holds up because Orwell's political incisiveness, when he talks about Newspeak, it applies to all kinds of spin, which we see every day, and it seems to only ever get worse.
1984 shot to number one on Amazon shortly after the inauguration, with this exchange on Meet the Press.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Alternative facts?
When Winston Smith stands up in front of us and says there are truth and there are facts,
freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4, because it does. That means something in this context.
Duncan McMillan co-authored and co-directs the adaptation, now on Broadway.
It's quite something to bring it to New York now in this political climate.
You don't have to be an expert to know that Newspeak is the only language in the world whose vocabulary gets smaller every year. It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words.
The audience reaction changes nightly, depending on the current news cycle, says Duncan McMillan. We spoke the day after President Trump announced the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords.
Last night was like a sort of volatile town hall meeting. People were shouting out resist, people were arguing with characters and applauding certain sentiments. And it wasn't just, you know, a liberal audience. It was little pockets around the room sort of debating with each other. And that felt really live and exciting.
The actors feel it too. Tom Sturridge plays Winston Smith, the protagonist.
We're all in this room together. We're all experiencing this together. And we influence each other. Like the way you listen, the way you react, shout out in this play, which is extraordinary, makes you enormously complicit in the evening that we have together.
I change the truth. I falsify articles. I write lies. I delete things, records, photographs, people, like your grandfather.
You delete?
Yes, I push a button and they never existed at all.
Winston's lover, Julia, is played by Olivia Wilde. People have a tendency to forget there's a love story at the center of 1984. She says the stage adaptation messes with the audience's heads, as does the book. Winston Smith is willing to do anything to bring down the government for which he works, even when pressed by the duplicitous character, O'Brien.
While we're on stage, we can feel the audience slowly falling into line behind Winston. They embrace him as their hero. They root for him. And then he has the line. Well, O'Brien says, if it would help the party, would you throw acid in a small child's face? And we can hear this gasp from the audience. And he says, yes. And suddenly we question, hang on a minute. Am I Winston? I thought I was Winston. Am I willing to go that far? I don't think I am.
The adaptation forthrightly deals with the novel's concepts. Who controls information and language to assert power? Living in a perpetual present. The concept of doublethink, keeping two opposing thoughts in one's mind while genuinely believing both. But it's the visceral nature of the production, with graphic images of torture, which has made some audience members walk out. Co-adapter Duncan McMillan.
It's not an easy evening, I should warn people. It doesn't give you any conclusions, actually, and it leaves you with something, I hope, if it works properly, to resolve in yourself and with each other and to try and work out what the hell it is you've just been exposed to, as it is with the novel.
Amanda Bias, a high school teacher from New Jersey who came with a group of co-workers, teaches the book to her seniors.
I don't think kids necessarily know what they're always getting as a source and the information they're getting. We have to teach them what's right and what's wrong and at least what's credible. I think that's a pretty good message.
Especially, she says, in the world we live in now, where 2 + 2 can sometimes equal 5. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The table was set last week for Chris Hart to declare his candidacy for the Republican nomination for governor of Pennsylvania. The 34-year-old entrepreneur had recently returned to his home state from Washington, D.C., where he had owned a neighborhood grocery store, worked on a Senate staff, and started a program to help the homeless. What better time to run for office? Hart planned his announcement for last Thursday, but then he got a call from a reporter. A public radio reporter, in fact, Dave Davies of our member station WHYY in Philadelphia, had a question for the prospective candidate. What about the residency requirement? Oh, that. Turns out the Pennsylvania Constitution requires candidates running for governor to have lived in the Keystone State for a minimum of 7 years before the election. Having moved back home just last month, Hart was way, way short. But you can't keep a would-be Paul down. Chris Hart now says he's considering a run for the U.S. Senate from Pennsylvania, an office that does not have a prior residency requirement. Herda Saunders knew something was wrong. She kept getting confused, losing her place in lessons at the University of Utah, where she taught. And then, just before she turned 61, Herta Saunders was given a diagnosis. She has early-onset microvascular dementia. Saunders and her husband Peter are South African. They immigrated to the States back in the 1980s. Now, at age 67, Herta Saunders has written a memoir titled Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. And she remembers vividly what her rather blunt neurologist said when she gave Saunders the news.
She said, "It looks like you may already have been dementing."
Dementing.
Dementing. And because I'm involved with words, I have always been, it just struck me in that moment really as funny in a way that there's this verb that I never thought could be derived from the noun dementia. Suddenly it felt like this was something I was, there's a word for it, when you participate in an act, I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Yeah,
but when you are sort of almost like guilty of participating in an act. I mean, in the way that we speak about it in colonialism, that you complicit is the word.
Uh-huh.
I think that I'm complicit in something here. That my body is and my head is doing something in a verb form, which means like I'm actively engaged in doing this.
You describe throughout the book some of the daily frustrations or failures with relatively simple tasks that you're confronting. And one of them is what you call the typical progression of a Herta phone call. Could you read that progression for us?
Okay.
On page 81.
One, find the phone number. I no longer remember any phone numbers except now and then my own. Is it in my electronic or paper address book? Two, if electronic, open email to search contacts. Three, forget why email is open, start catching up with unanswered messages. Four, eventually remember the original intention, sometimes. Five, retrieve number, go to the phone, hear the message beep. 6. Retrieve messages. Return urgent calls. 7. Start cleaning the counter where the phone is plugged in. 8. Damn, who was I going to call again?
What do you think the process of writing about your early onset dementia has meant in terms of understanding your identity now and how it's shifting?
Certainly, my whole life path was determined by the fact that I had a good brain to start with. I was very fortunate. And now this brain is being eaten away. So what am I now? What will I be? What is my identity? And what does it mean to live with an identity that's eroding all the time? Mm. I felt a strong feeling to understand this disease before the time when I couldn't understand anything anymore.
I'm wondering how your diagnosis of dementia has altered your relationship with your husband, Peter. You've been together for so long, since you were 17.
Yes. It has a constant and daily effect on our relationship. And I am more convinced than I've ever been in my life that Peter loves me until the day I die, because he is so tender and loving and just always there for me. And it's hard for me to know that I'm not fully reciprocating. You know, my mind drifts. I'm not good at doing my share of the household. Like I'm getting worse at it every day. His responsibility is mounting. But we do talk about it, and I feel that our relationship is deeper than it's ever been.
I think people listening to you, as eloquent as you are, will have a hard time wrapping themselves around the notion that you have dementia.
you do not sound at all impaired.
Yes, and that is true. If you are in a conversation with me like this, where there are no distractions, I can hold together, you know, a framework of concepts and speak within that framework. Where you see really some kind of craziness is when I interface with the world. I have severe attention deficit disorder. So I see something in front of me, and that is the thing I interact with. You know, Peter and I have to go somewhere. We have an appointment, and I have to get ready. And I get sidetracked 10 times in minutes, you know, where I go to fetch something or I go to comb my hair. It's a very exhausting way to get through a physical day. Mm. And it's incredibly exhausting for Peter, too, because he's really thinking for two people. He's the one who reminds me, and in always in the kindest way, about what I was supposed to be doing.
You've had many conversations with your family about the end of life and what you want that to be, how you want that to look and go, and what they want from that as well. Where have you ended up on that?
We worked out a plan for me and my family whereby I would go somewhere where I could find a legal assisted death. At the moment, it does not look as though that will be possible in the United States. So that means we would have to go to another country. And so we have tried to financially provide for that possibility and also emotionally prepare for that possibility with my family. And we have a plan set up through a lawyer, and my doctors are all aware of this and have my wishes in my advanced medical directives about this. And I ask this gift of them to do this for me. It is such a comfort to me to know that my family love me enough to want to give me this gift.
And it does, it feels like a gift to you to know that.
It does. It's a huge gift.
I worry that this has been exhausting for you, this interview.
But in a lovely way. I enjoy being able to have these conversations while I can, because I know that possibly in a year I might not be able to do it.
Herta Saunders' memoir is titled Memory's Last Breath, Field Notes on My Dementia. Herta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been wonderful. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading.
B.J. Lederman composes our theme music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. From Eli Lilly and Company, striving to unite caring with discovery to make life better. Stories on what inspires Lilly scientists in their pursuit of life-changing medicines to treat breast cancer is available at lillyforbetter.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is 90.9 WBUR. It's 60 degrees in Boston as Weekend Edition continues at 9 o'clock.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum, presenting Park Fest, a day-long festival celebrating art, nature, and creativity, Saturday, June 24th. More at DeCordova.org. Kimball Fruit Farm, an eco-friendly farm with farmers markets throughout Greater Boston. Today in Union Square, tomorrow in Harvard Square. KimballFruitFarm.com. And Medallion Gallery, announcing the store closing June 30th. Hand-woven new and antique rugs in a variety of sizes and designs available now. More at MedallionGallery.com.
The news cycle can be overwhelming at times. Just when you think it's calming down, another big story rolls in. Don't let the news knock you down. We've got all you need to know to ride the wave. I'm Michelle Martin. This summer, you stay cool. We'll bring you the up-to-date information and thoughtful analysis every weekend on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 5 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR Boston, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, and 89.1 WBUH Brewster. Online at WBUR.org and the new WBUR Listen app for iPhone and Android. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Melissa Block. A reversal of policy on Cuba. President Trump reinstates restrictions on travel and commerce. We'll hear reaction from Cubans and from U.S. tourists.
I'm an embarrassed American now. He is taking us back into time.
Also this hour, when congressional hearings become must-see TV, our Ron Elving looks back from the Army-McCarthy hearings through Watergate, Iran-Contra, and more, and lessons from the drum section, how a scientist became principal timpanist with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra.
You have to really embrace failure. Frame it as constructive growth.
First, our newscast. It's Saturday, June 17th, 2017.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. United Nations Special Envoy for Syria is planning a fresh round of peace talks. Stephanie Mistura's office says he wants to resume negotiations next month in Geneva. Meanwhile, the Syrian military has announced a 48-hour ceasefire in the southern city of Deraa. Deraa has seen some of the worst fighting in months. Seven crew members from the guided missile destroyer USS Fitzgerald remain missing after a collision with a huge container ship. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Tokyo that the Fitzgerald's commanding officer was among at least three who were seriously injured.
The collision occurred off the southeast coast of Japan at 2:30 in the morning. The area is extremely busy with shipping heading in and out of Tokyo Bay. However, the USS Fitzgerald is one of the most advanced warships in the world, with extremely sophisticated radar systems. There will now be lots of questions about why its crew failed to avoid collision with a slow-moving, 200-meter-long container ship.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes. Hundreds of people on the streets of St. Paul, Minnesota last night after a jury acquitted the police officer who killed motorist Philando Castile. Minnesota Public Radio's Dwali Sai Kowtow reports.
When a jury found Officer Geronimo Yanez not guilty of second-degree manslaughter and felony weapons charges, Valerie Castile, the mother of the shooting victim, burst out in court shouting profanity. Later, she told reporters her son was murdered.
My son loved this city, and this city killed my son. And the murderer gets away.
Castile was killed last July when he was pulled over for a broken taillight. This case attracted national attention after Castile's girlfriend streamed the aftermath of the shooting on Facebook. For NPR News, I'm Dwahli Saikautau in St. Paul.
A statement on the city's website says that Officer Yanez will not return to active duty under a voluntary separation agreement. Despite questions about President Trump's new policy on Cuba, it has been largely well received by the Cuban exile community in Miami. Peter Hayden reports from member station WLRN.
Feelings of triumph brewed like Cuban coffee on some corners of Little Havana as President Trump announced new business and travel restrictions with Cuba. 92-year-old Luis Conte Agüero fled the island in 1961.
His policy will be against the Castro tyranny, so I support that policy.
Many Cubans here, like Dulce Maria Perez, are encouraged by Trump's demands for key reforms from the Castro regime.
The previous presidents would always make us empty promises, but now I see true freedom is near for our country.
This community is hopeful that freedom will come from new restrictions.
You're listening to NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Sharon Brody in Boston. Fog is delaying the start of today's grand parade of sail. This is the main event of Sail Boston 2017. More than 50 vessels from around the world will sail into Boston. The tall ships parade had been scheduled to be getting underway just about now, but it has been pushed back until next hour. Locke Tran from Boston is a crew member aboard the Coast Guard's tall ship, the Eagle.
We're right outside of the Boston Harbor. There's a lot of fog out. It's a little hard to see, and there's a lot of tall ships around us right now.
WBUR's meteorologist David Epstein says the weather will improve.
You should expect mostly cloudy skies throughout the day into the afternoon hours. Temperatures getting into the low to mid-70s. Can't rule out a shower, but most of the time is dry. And I suggest to bring some sunscreen because even though it's cloudy, you can still get burned with all these clouds.
Organizers have prepared for 2 million visitors to Sail Boston 2017 over 5 days. Today, the MBTA is running subway trains as frequently as it does during weekday rush hours. Extra trains are running on the commuter rail. Many streets and neighborhoods leading to the harbor are being closed to traffic. 13 people are recovering from injuries after the high-speed ferry they were on crashed into a jetty as it entered Hyannis Harbor last night. The Steamship Authority believes choppy seas and strong winds contributed to the crash of its vessel. The Hyannis fire chief says none of the injuries are life-threatening. 57 people had been on board. Some were lifted off the ferry by a Coast Guard helicopter. The ferry was making its last trip of the day from Nantucket. In sports, the Red Sox beat the Astros 2-1 last night. They play again tonight in Houston, and tonight at Gillette, the Revs host the Chicago Fire. Again, cloudy today, some areas of fog, some scattered showers, thunderstorms possible, and highs today in the low 70s. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by GEICO, protecting people and their vehicles for over 75 years. GEICO is proud to offer car insurance and more to Massachusetts drivers, too. Additional information at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. That's 1-800-947-AUTO. And Whole Foods Market, offering brews, grooming products, and Father's Day meal ingredients. Recipes with a Father's Day theme are available at wholefoodsmarket.com. Whole Foods Market, we believe in real food.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block. Scott Simon is away. President Trump went to Miami yesterday and reversed course on recent U.S.-Cuba policy that had eased restrictions on business and travel. The Obama administration had adopted a policy of openness with the island nation. And to understand these changes, we're joined by NPR's Carrie Kahn, who joins us from Havana. Carrie, what have Cubans been telling you about these changes announced by the Trump administration yesterday?
The Cubans that I talked to are very worried and upset. Mostly I spoke to people that are tied to the tourism industry, either directly or indirectly. And they're just concerned about how this retrenchment is going to hit them. You know, tourism has boomed here in the past 2.5 years since President Obama and Raul Castro warmed relations. And especially American travelers coming to Cuba have given this economy a much needed boost. You know, any drop in those numbers of visitors are just people are afraid that there'll be job loss. And the Cuban economy is not in good shape right now for a variety of reasons. So any blow is very worrisome right now.
And what about reaction from the Cuban government, from the Communist Party there?
Well, the official organ of the Communist Party, Granma, immediately condemned the speech. They just called it old imperialistic rhetoric from decades gone by, and they said it's putting Cuban-U.S. relations back in the freezer. Then at night, Trump's speech was rebroadcast and translated on the official newscast. And then the commentaries just came rolling in. I think the lead newscaster read a long attack of the speech for about 45 minutes and then read off a long list of human rights abuses in the U.S., proving U.S. hypocrisy and double standards. You know, they listed everything from mass shootings in the U.S. to police shootings of African Americans to pay disparity of women. And, you know, the list just went on. And then Cubans did as, you know, they always have said, they're willing to have a dialogue that they say is respectful to each country's sovereignty. So at least they didn't close the door to further negotiations, as President Trump insisted yesterday.
Yeah. Carrie, you mentioned that tourism has been on the upswing in Cuba, and you've been talking with tourists there in Havana. What have they been saying?
You know, I actually watched Trump's speech yesterday with a bunch of American tourists. Many were unaware of the changes, and they were asking me questions like, are they going to be able to get home? That's not a problem. It will take months for the changes to be put in place. A lot of these people came under the people-to-people category, which now doesn't really require much evidence that you actually engaged in such an experience, but the new changes will require travelers to come on organized trips. And a lot of people said that will be more costly and they won't come. One man that I spoke with, his name is Mike Connors, his reaction was really typical of a lot of the Americans I spoke with.
I'm an embarrassed American now. He is taking us back into time.
Many travelers said that they took exception to Trump's claim that their dollars were going to prop up a repressive regime. One woman shouted at me. She said, I've been here 48 hours and all my money's gone directly to the people. She was staying in private homes and eating in private restaurants.
Carrie, the idea behind the policy of engagement under the Obama administration was that that would be the way to bring change to Cuba. Of course, the Trump administration says that has not been working. What do you think, based on what you're seeing on the ground, is the reality there?
I think the short answer is that it's only been 2 years since these changes have been put in place, and people said the policy of isolation was in place for more than 50 years. So let's give this one more of a chance.
It's NPR's Carrie Kahn speaking with us from Havana. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And for American entrepreneurs who looked at Cuba and saw an untapped market of more than 11 million people, Trump's new policy is disappointing. Charles Lane from member station WSHU reports.
Academics estimated that U.S. companies would have grossed about $4.5 billion over the next 4 years in trade and tourism with Cuba. Most of that is tourism, which is likely to decrease now that Americans can only travel with groups. Augusto Maxwell is a lawyer who advises companies doing business in Cuba. He says American travelers like their freedom.
They're going to be upset that they now have to go with a tour group that is going to control their agenda versus their ability to go there, stay at an Airbnb, and go to a private restaurant and make their own conclusions.
600,000 Americans traveled to Cuba last year, about the same number who traveled to Australia. Maxwell predicts the number of flights will drop, but the number of cruise ship passengers will likely remain the same. That's because cruise ship passengers often travel in groups. The big crunch will be on where to sleep. Havana's official hotel sites are all over capacity, which opened the door to the room renting site Airbnb. They book about 10,000 rooms a year to Americans. Regulators still have to write the rules, so right now it's unclear how the new policy will be enforced. What's also unclear is if the multi-million dollar hotel deal between the Cuban military and Starwood, which is owned by Marriott, is still viable. The White House said all previously inked deals are still valid, but they also said Americans will not be permitted to stay at military-owned hotels. Overall, Maxwell says the mood in the tourism industry is down.
In order to promote freedom in Cuba, they're denying Americans the freedom to travel. And I think that that's controversial.
The Trump administration says that America's long-term partner is the Cuban people, not the Cuban government, which the administration criticizes as oppressive and anti-American. Richard Feinberg says that's true. He is a professor of international political economy at UC San Diego. He says even though the current embargo allows for American telecom companies to do business, the Cuban government has been reluctant.
Google actually went down there and said to the Cubans, hey, we will wire the whole island and we'll do it free of charge. And the Cubans said, no thanks. We're scared that an American firm might compromise our security, and we prefer to deal with the Chinese at this point.
For American entrepreneurs, this is frustrating. Right now, we only export about $200 million a year in commodities and humanitarian products. Feinberg says it could be so much more. Trump's rollback, he says, cedes the head start advantages to other countries. But just because the U.S. is pulling out, that doesn't necessarily mean foreign companies will rush into Cuba. Risa Grace Targo is an analyst at the Eurasia Group.
Because the Helms-Burton Act of 1996 actually allows for the U.S. to punish third parties that do business with Cuba, we've actually seen a pretty limited amount of foreign companies doing business on the island.
Grace Targo says that when U.S. restrictions were first eased, there was growing excitement from across the global business community to make investments in Cuba. But now she expects that excitement to wane. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane.
In his past life, Donald Trump put a reality TV spin on what it means to be an apprentice. And as president, he's pushing apprenticeships in real life. He signed an executive order this week to loosen government requirements and increase federal grants to create millions of apprentice jobs. More and more companies seem intrigued by the idea of returning to apprenticeships, but so far, that interest hasn't sparked a big revival. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
Business leaders always point to the Germans as the model. And when Volkswagen built its only plant in the U.S., it also imported its workforce training philosophy. In a highly selective program, apprentices spend 3 years splitting their time between the production line and these robotic labs.
Now the equipment we have, the technology we have on the shop floors, are so difficult to handle. So you need to train people.
Christian Koch is wrapping up his term heading the VW plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But when he was starting his own career, he too was an apprentice.
I did it from 1979 to 1982.
It's a rite of passage, even for executives. And it's an acknowledgement that the company bears a lot of responsibility for training. Ilker Subasi helped launch VW's U.S. apprenticeship program.
We don't expect any experience because we want to train them for our processes and for our needs.
But this kind of company-sponsored education can easily reach into the six figures. So even with government incentives, it's costly. Many students also get VW's help to work abroad or finish a bachelor's degree, and they end the program with a $22 an hour job. Caleb Higginbotham was one of the first graduates.
I knew Volkswagen tried to kind of take care of its employees, but I didn't know that it would be as exceptional and like all the benefits they provide and everything they're willing to do to try and help out.
Volkswagen's view is that investing in people pays off when they spend an entire career wearing the company uniform, and many do. But when it comes to apprenticeship, Tamar Jacoby, who's president of Opportunity America, says not everyone has such deep pockets.
The companies that can pull it off should pull it off, and I'd like to see a lot more of them do it. But it's a little bit like a marathon.
She says it's hard for small businesses to take such a long view. If the government is putting more money into apprenticeships, Jacoby says grants should be made available for smaller scale programs too. But money isn't always the deterrent. Jacoby's organization, which focuses on training for low-income people, recently sat down with companies that flirted with starting apprenticeships but passed.
Almost to a company, what they said was, no, we'd train anyway. We know we have to train, and we know training costs money. But what we actually don't want to do, we don't want the government involved in this.
In response to concerns about red tape, President Trump's proposal attempts to streamline the Labor Department's regulation of apprenticeships. For instance, companies could oversee themselves. That could run into resistance. But Jacoby says it may push companies that already have extensive training to take the plunge into apprenticeships. For example, in Smyrna, Tennessee, Nissan partnered with a state-run tech school near its flagship U.S. plant.
So it's literally right across the street.
Spokesperson Parul Bajaj says Nissan provides 4 full-time instructors. Students aren't guaranteed a job, but they've got a leg up.
The facility is a great way for us to ensure that there's, you know, a steady pipeline of students who have these great manufacturing and automation skills.
Nissan is even offering part-time work for second-year students, though it's not an official apprenticeship, at least not yet. But more big employers will have to get on board to hit the administration's lofty goal of 4.5 million apprentices. Currently in the U.S., they're just 500,000. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This is 90.9 WBUR. It's 61 degrees in Boston at 918. Coming up on Weekend Edition Saturday, as Sail Boston draws big crowds to Boston Harbor for a tall ships parade. The parade's been rescheduled for a 10 a.m. start. It's a one-hour delay because of fog. You'll meet the captain of the Oliver Hazard Perry. That's coming up on Weekend Edition. From the WBUR iLab, check out The Artery, Boston's online arts destination. Today, revisiting Julius Caesar, theater in the age of Trump. That's The Artery at WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Firestone and Parson. Over 60 years on Newbury Street. Fine estate jewelry, diamonds, rare antique silver. 30 Newbury Street, Boston. Firestoneandparson.com. The law firm of Nutter, McLennan, and Fish. Counsel to leading companies and institutions for more than a century. Client-focused, collaborative. This is Nutter. Online at Nutter.com. And Cambridge School of Culinary Arts. Hosting an open house July 20th at 5. Cooking demos, instructor meet and greet. Registration and more at CambridgeCulinary.com.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. A U.S. Navy destroyer is back at its home base in Japan, but seven sailors remain missing following a collision with a container ship. At least three crew members were injured, including the commanding officer. In Massachusetts, bad weather is being blamed for last night's accident in which a high-speed ferry carrying nearly 50 passengers struck a jetty and grounded on rocks at the entrance to Hyannis Harbor. At least six people were injured. The Coast Guard says crews worked overnight to transfer passengers and crew. And President Trump is headed to Camp David this weekend. His trip there is his first to the presidential retreat in the Maryland Mountains since he took office. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that all lives have equal value and working with partners to help envision a world where every person has the opportunity to live a healthy, productive life at gatesfoundation.org. From EBSCO, offering Flipster digital magazines for libraries to share knowledge and expand young imaginations, available via computer, tablet, phone, or the Flipster app. Learn more at flipster.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Will the Brexit be hard, soft, or maybe no Brexit at all? Those questions are roiling Britain as the now weakened Prime Minister, Theresa May, weighs her options for negotiating an exit from the European Union. May's Conservative Party lost its majority in Parliament in last week's snap election after promising a hard Brexit, a clean break with the EU. So with negotiations between the UK and the EU scheduled to start on Monday, what happens now? We've asked George Parker to break this down for us. He's political editor of the Financial Times in London, and he joins us from Milbank Studios. Mr. Parker, welcome.
Hello.
Let's talk first about the path of the hard Brexit. What would that involve?
As you say, it would basically represent a clean break for Britain from the European Union. So we'd leave the main aspects of the EU, notably the single market. It's the world's richest single market, a bit like NAFTA for North America. We'd leave the customs union, which means that Britain at the moment is able to export goods to Europe without any tariffs and without any checks at the frontier. And we'd also be allowed to control immigration from the EU, which at the moment we're not allowed to do under the rules of the European Union. So those are the main elements of the so-called hard Brexit. But as you say, the vision of Brexit that Theresa May presented to the electorate has been more or less rejected by the public.
Right. So now scenarios are being entertained that would be softer. How soft? What would that mean?
So the pro-Europeans in the cabinet, and there are quite a few of them who were rather cowed before the election, are now flexing their muscles. And they're talking about a version of Brexit which takes a bit longer. So we have lengthy transition periods to give companies and the government time to adapt. Some people are saying we should stay in the customs union for a bit longer, maybe even forever, which would mean that we wouldn't face these tariffs and border controls. And generally, putting business ahead of all else and the economy ahead of all else, because Theresa May is someone who comes from a security background. She used to be the Home Secretary, and she was very concerned about controlling immigration. That was top of her menu, really, in Brexit. And that's really concerned British business, which has thrived, really, over the last 50 years or so by having very open borders, attracting the best and the brightest people into the country, particularly to the City of London and financial services sector. So I think less emphasis on controlling immigration and more emphasis on smoothing this over for business.
What would the practical effects be of these different options? How would Britons be affected in everyday life?
Well, I think people's day-to-day life may not be affected all that much, because at the moment, Britons can travel freely between Europe and the UK. There's talk about when Britain leaves the EU that we might have to get some kind of visa waiver to travel to the continent and vice versa. But I think more importantly is the economic impact of leaving the EU, that by Britain leaving this huge single market, this huge free trade area with tariff barriers being put up, that people's jobs and livelihoods will be affected.
Aren't there also concerns about the rights of the 3 million EU citizens who are living in the UK?
That's right. That's the very first thing that will be discussed in these Brexit negotiations, which start on Monday. Britain is preparing to make what it calls a very generous offer to the 3 million people living in the UK at the moment. So basically saying that the rights that they have at the moment as EU citizens will be preserved when Britain leaves the EU. I think the hope is that that will get the talks off to a good start. Both sides want the same thing. So the Polish government wants good rights for Polish citizens living in the UK. And likewise, the UK wants to have good rights preserved for British citizens living in other parts of Europe. So, for example, we have a large number of retired people living in Spain and France. And in fact, strangely, one of the paradoxes of Brexit is that we export our elderly and we import the young and productive workers from other parts of Europe. And it's one of the things, strangely, which the British public seem to have rejected in the Brexit referendum.
I had mentioned earlier the no Brexit scenario. Is that realistic? Is there any path for Britain to say, you know, never mind, we're going to stay in the EU after all?
I think it's really unlikely at the moment. You know, in 2 years' time, Britain will leave the European Union unless there's a national change of heart, and unless the EU, of course, decides they want us to stay. Look, I mean, 82% of voters supported Brexit. It seems very unlikely. On the other hand, there are still people who hope that one day, maybe after we see the economic consequences of what we're doing and possibly an economic downturn over the next 2 years, that people will change their mind. But at the moment, I think that's a very unlikely scenario.
Okay, George Parker, political editor with the Financial Times in London. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Florida has just joined a number of states that charge drug dealers with murder if their customers overdose on drugs containing the synthetic opioid fentanyl. It's touched off a debate about whether these laws are used to prosecute the right people and whether they endanger the drug users they're designed to protect. Peter Hayden of member station WLRN reports.
22-year-old Ty Hernandez was mending a broken heart when he felt a cold coming on. His mom, Peggy, did the mom thing. "You've got to rest and drink fluids," she said. The next morning,
I left a note on the counter with some chicken noodle soup and said, "I hope you feel better. Call me if you need anything," and I went to work.
Ty had recently broken up with his girlfriend in Maine and moved back in with his folks. Their house sits on a lake in a leafy subdivision in Wellington, Florida. Ty's mom was glad to have him back.
We got home at 5:30, and I noticed that nothing was messed with on the counter.
So she went upstairs to check on him.
I opened the door, and I found him on his bed dead, cold and dead.
Under Ty's body, a charred scrap of aluminum foil, a lighter, and a hollow tube from a ballpoint pen. Tools for smoking heroin. Ty had died of an overdose, but not heroin.
It was full strength. 100% fentanyl.
Fentanyl, the powerful synthetic opioid that killed Prince, Ty Hernandez, and thousands of other Americans last year. It's over 50 times more potent than morphine. The deadly nature of the drug prompted state lawmakers to take action this year. Now, Florida law allows people who distribute a fatal dose of fentanyl to be charged with drug-induced homicide. And Florida law enforcement is getting the word out to drug dealers.
Enjoy trying to sleep tonight, wondering if tonight's the night our SWAT team blows your front door off the hinges.
Lake County Sheriff Peyton Grinnell recently put out a public service announcement on YouTube. He stands staring into the camera, flanked on either side by four motionless deputies in ski masks.
If our agents can show the nexus between you, the pusher of poison, and the person that overdoses and dies, we will charge you with murder. We are coming for you. Run.
Drug-induced homicide laws are not new. More than 20 states have them. Most were put on the books decades ago during the height of the war on drugs. But prosecutors around the country are now dusting them off to combat the raging opioid epidemic. The charges are often hard to prove, but in Ty Hernandez's death, the evidence was jumping out at them.
Ty's phone was just ringing off the hook. This name kept popping up, Slim, 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 texting, dude, where's my money? Dude, where's my money?
That phone and other evidence led a federal jury to convict Slim, a 24-year-old drug dealer named Christopher Messina, of drug-induced homicide for selling Ty Hernandez the dose of pure fentanyl that took his life. Messina was sentenced to 30 years in prison. The expanded Florida statute now gives state prosecutors the same heavy hammer. Palm Beach County State Attorney Dave Ehrenberg says they need it.
The person who is spreading this poison needs to be held accountable, and that will mean handcuffs and long prison sentences.
But a report by the Drug Policy Alliance says there's no evidence that the laws reduce overdoses or drug use. Instead, the report says the laws often ensnare friends or family members who are just sharing their drugs, not professional dealers. Critics also say the harsh statutes undermine Good Samaritan laws, meant to encourage people to call 911 when someone is overdosing.
We see situations where people leave the home and call 911 from a payphone or from another home because they're concerned about prosecution.
Art Way is director of criminal justice reform for the Drug Policy Alliance.
And when you add murder to that mix, you're only increasing that dynamic and driving things further and further underground.
For moms like Peggy Hernandez, punishing drug dealers and getting them off the street remains the number one priority. She lost her son to fentanyl, but another mom lost her son to prison.
I feel for her. I hurt for her. But unlike me, she still can hug her son if she chooses to. She can still go see her son if she chooses to. She can call and talk to him on the phone if she chooses to. I don't have that.
Peggy hopes state officials will name the drug-induced homicide statute Ty's Law after her son. For NPR News, I'm Peter Hayden in Wellington, Florida.
Medical care is so expensive that it can lead to bankruptcy. Tomorrow on Weekend Edition, Lulu Garcia Navarro speaks with a woman who has turned to crowdsourcing to pay for her medical expenses. And it's time now for sports. The Golden State Warriors mopped up the Cleveland Cavaliers this week, handily putting an end to the NBA season. But baseball season is in full swing, and Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN the magazine is always game to talk us through it. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, Lisa. How are you?
I'm great. And let's start with the American League and the Yankees, currently on top in the American League East. I gather they are pinning huge hopes on a rookie named Aaron Judge.
Not just any rookie named Aaron Judge, a 6'7", 282-pound rookie named Aaron Judge who tends, you would look at him and think that he belongs in a football field, but he is amazing. And it's kind of fun being in 2017, how strange it is for us to actually root for the Yankees, the dreaded 27-time New York Yankees.
Not who strange are kind for of me, Howard, speak for yourself.
Who are underdogs right now. Why are we rooting for the Yankees? That's unheard of. Well, it's because baseball needs this. Baseball needs a shot of a dynasty to come back and to have a young player playing in the big city doing big things. And he is hitting the ball. He hit almost a 500-foot home run last week, and he's everything that people are talking about. It's good to see the Yankees. Scott and I have this argument all the time about dynasties. I love when big teams are doing great things because they're the teams you remember, teams that you circle on the calendar, teams you hate. It's what sports is really all about. And the Yankees have been a very mediocre, average team for the last 5 years. They haven't won the World Series since 2009. They haven't been to the American League Championship since 2012, I believe, or 2012. And so it's a nice thing to see. And Aaron Judge is doing things that people who you would think are rational people are comparing to Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, and it's like, well, wait a minute, he's only been here a couple of months. That's how exciting he's been.
No kidding. The Houston Astros are kind of a surprise favorite this season. What's been going right for them?
Well, and they've got the best record in baseball right now. And it's interesting because a couple of years ago, they were the team that people thought were going to be the next new team. They went to the American League Championship Series. They lost to Kansas City. Then last year, they didn't do so well, and they sort of fell off, and you'd wondered how a team that talented could have such a bad rebound from things. But this year, they're back, and they're playing great. You've got Hal's career, who's one of the best players in the game, in a wonderful lineup up and down. Jose Altuve, all 5'6" of him, is one of the best hitters in baseball. And they're playing the Boston Red Sox this weekend, which is a good series for both teams. And you look at Boston, you look at the Yankees, and you look at Houston, and you've got some nice stuff happening this year in the American League.
Okay, and on the National League side, can the Chicago Cubs make Scott Simon happy and repeat as World Series champions?
Repeat as World Series champions. They're not even, they're 500. They are an average team.
Oh,
let's, why don't we just call this out, Melissa, for what it is.
The
reason why
Scott
Simon is in Europe is because the Chicago Cubs are playing so poorly right now.
He couldn't stand
last year. Last year, they were tearing up the National League and baseball. They won 103 games. This year, they're 33-33. You would like to think that they've got a big run in them in the second half. They're still the most talented team in the league. They are an outstanding baseball club. But this is a new year, and it's one of the hardest things to do in baseball. We like to talk about, oh, well, you know, they're so good. They're not machines. Mm-hmm. And it's a new year, and you hadn't won since 1908, and the pressure of doing that and the pressure of repeating. And it's also very hard to do in the National League. The Phillies did it 2008, 2009, but you got to go back after that to the 70s, to Cincinnati, 75, 76, to see a team repeat in the National League. It's a very difficult thing to do, but if there's a team out there that has the talent to do it, it's the Chicago Cubs, and maybe Scott will come back to the country when they do.
Well, from your mouth to Scott Simon and other Cubs fans' ears, Howard Bryant of ESPN, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Good morning, I'm Sharon Brody. Sail Boston 2017 has arrived, but because of fog, the main event has been delayed by 1 hour this morning. The Grand Parade of Sail had been scheduled to get underway at 9 a.m. Now it is set to start at 10 this morning. Among the largest tall ships parading into the harbor is the Oliver Hazard Perry. Its home port is Newport, Rhode Island, and David Dawes is the ship's captain. He joins us now. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Sharon.
What goes into preparing the ship for the parade for you and your crew?
It's not just the crew at the moment. We have a full complement of close to 49 people at the moment, and we have a school on board, a group of school children. So at the moment, there's around 30 trainees, as we call them. They're not passengers, they're trainees, they're fully involved, and that's how the Coast Guard views them, and the ship's crew. Last week was a lot of preparation of the appearance of the ship, painting, rust and that sort of thing, and getting everything looking good. And then we've come very quickly from Newport, Rhode Island. We sailed all yesterday down from the Cape Cod Canal and arrived early in the evening. And then during the night, it's been cleaning the public spaces, getting the flags ready, just going over our directions for the parade. It's quite complicated, as you can imagine, marshalling dozens of large boats in close proximity with the possibility of wind, and then putting them all concentrated into Boston Harbor and then having to safely dock them. So the officers have put a lot of effort into making sure that we know how we're going to be communicating and what the expectations are of holding station to keep everybody safe and at their right distances as we go in and get ready. And then we've been reviewing security considerations for when we're alongside. We'll have hundreds of people coming through the ship. We'll be open to the public, and we'll have hundreds of people on board.
What do you think draws so many people to tall ships?
I think it's a throwback. I think it's like the Pirates of the Caribbean. I think it's a glimpse into other people's lives, even if they're just looking at a glimpse into our lives. If you look at some of the large foreign national ships that are going to be coming in, they have they have maybe 100 cadets on board, and these people have all signed on for this slightly arduous journey. I think people are fascinated by that, as well as the equipment themselves, especially when you look at the America's Cup, which is going on today in Bermuda, on catamarans, you know, doing 40 knots. And if we can do 4 knots, we're happy with that because we've got this 500-ton object going in the right direction to make our goal. And I think people are just fascinated with that throwback in a modern time.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about the challenges of maneuvering this 200-foot-long ship with 3 masts into Boston Harbor?
Sure. We have 2 engines and the propellers are quite close together, so it does make maneuvering a little bit difficult. I do have a small bow thruster, but it's very easy for both of them to be overwhelmed by the windage of the rig. We have a lot of windage up high because these ships were originally intended just to blow down or across the wind. So if we have a crosswind or a wind ahead of us, it does make it hard. If I'm maneuvering in a place where there's a lot more space, I'll do things like drop an anchor out in deeper water and then slowly let that anchor out and push against that anchor to give me some sense of control, kind of like walking, dragging a bucket of stones behind you. It sort of slows you down and lets you point where you're going a little bit more easily. But in this case, because they want to dock everybody quickly, we will cheat and have some very small tugs and docking pilots available so they can get all 40 of the ships bang, bang, bang into their slots very quickly so there isn't too much congestion. So I'm expecting help in there today, but if it was a normal docking situation, we would be able to do it with just our own resources. Like the old-time way, dropping an anchor and working in against that. I do have a small rescue boat as well that I launch, and I use that as a small poor man's tugboat, I call that, and use that to push the ship around too in calmer conditions. But it does take forethought and planning.
Well, welcome to Boston, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. We hope to see more of it when the fog lifts. And the forecast for the weekend is partly cloudy and in about the 60s, low 70s. So I think it's going to be a great weekend, and Boston will truly love this, and it will be very popular. And thank you for having us up here.
Well, thank you. That's David Dawes joining us from the Oliver Hazard Perry. The ship is named after a U.S. captain and naval hero in the War of 1812 and commander of the American Naval Fleet. This is 90.9 WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Heritage Museums and Gardens. 100 acres of family fun with this year's special exhibit, Painted Landscapes, Contemporary Views. Details at heritagemuseums.org. Orthopedics at Tufts Medical Center. Treatment for hips, knees, sports injuries, and back pain to get you back to enjoying life. TuftsMedicalCenter.org/ortho. And The Orchard with The Hero, starring Sam Elliott as an aging actor searching for one final role to cement his legacy. Also starring Nick Offerman and Catherine Ross, now playing.
In a small church in Sunnyvale, California, an unusual support group meets every Thursday.
I'm Ron, and I'm a racist.
I'm Morgan, and I'm a racist.
I'm May. I am a racist.
At Racists Anonymous, people hope to rid their minds of prejudice.
Keep coming back. It works.
This week, Invisibilia looks at the biased concepts in our heads and whether it's possible to change them.
That's tomorrow night at 8 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Americans for the Arts, dedicated to advancing an arts industry that employs 4.8 million people in towns and cities across the country. Learn more at americansforthearts.org. From Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 44 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. 45 years ago today, there was a burglary. You may have heard of it. It involved the Watergate Hotel. First, the break-in, then the political cover-up, and ultimately, the president's resignation. The congressional hearings on the Watergate scandal were must-see TV, making stars of senators and political junkies of a generation. The recent Capitol Hill appearances of Attorney General Jeff Sessions and fired FBI Director James Comey fall into that tradition. When we want a bit of history, we go to Professor Ron.
You know him as NPR's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on our Washington desk.
It didn't begin with Watergate. The first televised hearings on Capitol Hill to make history happened when TV was still in its infancy. It was 1954, and Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin was at the height of his self-appointed crusade against communists in the federal government, real or imagined.
I don't give a tinker's damn how high or how low people in either the Republican or Democrat party, either party, are unhappy about our methods. This fight is going to go on as long as I am in the United States Senate.
Even to be called before McCarthy's investigating committee could destroy an individual's career. Toward the end of the hearings, McCarthy took on the U.S. military and suggested that one of the attorneys representing the Army had leftist ties. That was too much for Joseph Welch, the head of the defense team. He interrupted McCarthy and had this exchange with him.
Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?
I know this hurts you, Mr. Welch.
That moment became a rallying point for McCarthy detractors, and in the summer of 1954, the Senate took up a censure motion against him that would pass later that year. By 1973, virtually every American home had at least one TV. So when all three networks chose to carry the Senate hearings on Watergate that summer, the story came to dominate everyday life. In the end, 319 hours of hearings were televised, and 85% of all American households watched at least some of that coverage. Among the witnesses who appeared was John Dean, who had been the White House counsel and intimately involved in covering up the connections between the Watergate burglars and President Richard Nixon's reelection campaign.
Well, I'm not here as a sinner seeking a confessional, but I have been asked to be here to tell the truth. And I had always planned at any time, before any forum, when asked, to tell the truth.
Revelations from the hearings ultimately led to Nixon's resignation.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Since that time, no one has underestimated the power of a televised hearing on Capitol Hill, which was again on display in 1987. That's when a joint House and Senate committee held more than 3 months of Watergate-style hearings into a scandal affecting President Ronald Reagan.
Fresh information tonight on the deep involvement of the CIA with the Contras.
Weapons had been sold secretly to Iran in exchange for the release of some hostages, with the proceeds of these sales going secretly to anti-communist insurgents in Nicaragua. The key figure here was Marine Colonel Oliver North, who had carried out much of the operation. He had done such a good job of lying to Congress in the past that a committee lawyer asked if North was still lying as he testified.
I am not lying to protect anybody, counsel. I came here to tell the truth. I told you that I was going to tell it to you, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Some of it has been ugly for me. I don't know how many other witnesses have gone through the ordeal that I have before arriving here and seen their names smeared all over the newspapers. And by some members of this committee.
North later became a popular public speaker and radio personality and even ran for the U.S. Senate.
I'm running for Senate because Washington's out of control and we need to make some changes.
Confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justices have provided other reliable moments of drama, none more so than Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas. Bork's hearings in 1987 helped turn public opinion against him. Thomas's hearings 4 years later featured Anita Hill's explosive allegations of sexual harassment. Nonetheless, Thomas made it, and Bork did not. Other than that, there has been a bit of a lull in recent years for blockbuster TV hearings on Capitol Hill, but then came the hearings for former FBI Director James Comey and Attorney General Jeff Sessions this month. Nearly 20 million viewers watched the Comey testimony alone. That was more than watched the NBA basketball finals. This could be a short-lived trend, or the heyday of the televised hearing may be making a comeback. Stay tuned. Ron Elving, NPR News, Washington.
Newsflash, the croissant is not in danger of extinction in France, despite alarmist headlines this week, which trumpeted a pastry panic and warned that the buttery French delicacy could soon become a thing of the past. We're here to reassure you, not so. Fake news. But it is true that the price of butter in France has soared, nearly doubling over the last year, so the French could end up paying more for their pastries. Who better to ask about all this than a French baker? François Brault joins us from his bakery Panifica in Paris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And what have you been seeing with the price of butter that you use in your bakery?
I've seen the same news. And in fact, I went back and checked exactly with my suppliers. And it's true that the price of low-quality butter has doubled.
Low-quality butter.
But high-quality butter we use, so far, they told me that the price I'm getting next Monday morning will be increased in price from what I paid last week. And they also said that I should see some more price increase towards a peak price in September.
Uh-huh. So what's behind the price increases, whether it's for low-quality or high-quality butter?
I think it's a matter of supply and demand. Maybe there is something in China that is importing milk, which makes it less available for turning into butter.
More international demand, falling milk yields, I've heard, too, there in France. Well, what does it mean for customers of yours who come into the bakery? Are they having to pay more already since butter prices have gone up?
First, we have to realize that when I sell bread or pastry, I don't sell flour. I sell labor. So the cost of ingredients is roughly speaking 25% of the full price of the goods.
Uh-huh. So most of the price, you're saying, is the work involved in creating the pastry or the bread. How much does a croissant cost right now at your bakery?
For us, it's €1.20. Which is clearly upscale. But again, we are using high-quality butter. We are using organic flour. And all we make is made in-house.
I'm telling you, $1.30, $1.35 for a wonderful croissant sounds like a pretty great deal to me.
For New York or Washington, it would be a very, very nice price. Same for Tokyo. And by the way, butter is about 75% of the cost of ingredients in a croissant. So the butter price does make a difference for the price of the croissant.
Are you hearing many people talk about the butter price hike and the possible shortage of butter that might be coming?
My colleague bakers, they start to, yes. And they say that they might end up increasing price, and they are worried because customers are extremely sensitive to the price of the baguette and the price of the croissant.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to increase price, you'd better communicate right. Otherwise, customers think that you are taking advantage of them.
Yeah. Do you think you could make a croissant with a butter substitute that would taste anything like the croissant that we know and love?
No, I don't think so. You can use margarine, but really, butter is king there.
Butter is king?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. That's François Brault. He's head baker and owner of Panifica, a bakery in Paris. Mr. Brault, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
How did a scientist become a principal timpanist with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra? Jason Haheim gets that question all the time. He's a former nanotechnologist with a master's in electrical engineering. He's 38, and 4 years ago, he made a major life pivot to play professionally with the Met Orchestra. The Met Orchestra is in its off-season right now, so Jason Haheim has plenty of time to join us from our studios in New York to talk about his winding career path. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be here.
Jason, why don't you describe the timpani for folks who might be thinking a bit about which one is that again?
Yeah.
Tell me about the timpani.
So a lot of times people, they're like, what do you do? I'm like, I play timpani in the Met Orchestra. And they're like, huh?
Yeah,
the kettle drums.
Ah.
Oh, the kettle drums, and it's a bum, 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 bum. You know, you think of the 2001 Space Odyssey, the also Sprach Zarathustra theme. It's like, yes, those are the timpani. The big kettle copper instruments in the back of the orchestra. Usually have four of them arranged in front of me in sort of a semicircle. And they have pedals on them, and they can get different pitches by changing the tension of the drum head.
So you describe in your blog how you started auditioning for orchestras from everywhere, from Baltimore to Oslo. You were auditioning over and over and over and getting nowhere. You call yourself a tenacious loser. And I wonder how you powered through all those failures.
I think for a lot of people, and that's not just in orchestral music, but a lot of people in performing arts, acting, just anything like this, you start off with a desire to do this thing, this passion about some sort of art form, and yet you're not skilled enough. Your craft has not evolved to the point you'd be able to do it.
Hmm.
So I think a defining experience for a lot of people who get into these creative fields is you have to really embrace failure, frame it as constructive growth, and be interested in that.
Were there a lot of moments when you just wanted to give up, just to say, you know, I've had my run, I've tried and tried, and it's not working, I'm gonna stay in science?
You know, I saw a lot of people around me in the audition circuit racked by that question. You know, basically, a lot of times, like the timpani community, it's very collegial, you know,
yeah.
And a lot of us end up at the same bar after the audition. And, you know,
Two Tiffany's walked into a bar.
Yeah, totally. No, or like 17, you know, and,
yeah.
And at that party afterwards, of course, there's some of the people who are like, oh, man, like, I don't know how long I can keep doing this. I don't know how long I can keep this up. And it was kind of at that point I realized, oh, man, I have a major advantage here, which is that I have this other career, which gives me sustainability in this. My efforts don't have an expiration date.
So when you're playing with an opera orchestra, as you are with the Met Orchestra, what's the role that you see of yourself as the timpanist in conveying the dramatic action on stage?
Yeah, it's a great question, because a lot of times, as timpanists, we're sort of taught by teachers and mentors to, you know, your playing should be expressive and it should tell a story. And, you know, in works, symphonic works by Beethoven or Brahms or something, you know, your playing should definitely be expressive. But in opera, you're telling a very specific story. No matter how you play it, a comedy like Elisir d'Amore by Donizetti is still going to be a comedy. And something like Parsifal by Wagner is still going to be a intense drama. And that's sort of the dramatic world you're in. And so in the instance of two examples that I was working with, both by Puccini, La Bohème and Tosca, the printed timpani parts as written show an E natural fortissimo roll. And if I didn't really know what the story was, it could be easy to just play them basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
But these moments are dramatically different in terms of what's happening in the story. In the first instance,
In La Bohème,
the character Marcello is redeclaring his love for his ex-girlfriend, Musetta. And in the second instance, Tosca, the heroine of the story, finally gets her chance to stab in the heart the villain, Scarpia.
And that's you, conveying that through the
timpani as
well.
I am the stab. I am the knife.
What do you think the points of intersection are for you, Jason, between your science brain and your music brain? Where do they merge?
Almost completely. In a way, the question of, like, do I miss science is one I get a lot, too. And, you know, my basic answer is no, because I'm still doing so much of that. I kind of get to scratch that itch through, you know, this extensive analysis of opera scores. I do a lot of work with timpani mallets and design and kind of making those for myself, getting data about them. And, you know, science for me is this kind of concept of, it's motivated by fundamental curiosity, seeking outward. Whereas music and art is kind of this similar curiosity, but it's seeking inward. It's kind of trying to understand our humanity. And so it just feels more like two different directions on the same axis.
Jason Haheim is principal timpanist with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra in New York. Jason, thanks so much for being with us.
Melissa, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Susan Stamberg. As a kid, when I caught a cold, my mother would bring the white Bakelite radio in from the kitchen, fluff up my pillows, and we would spend the day listening to soap operas. It was magical. It still is, telling stories, making pictures in the mind's eye, wrapping us in a blanket of sound. Public radio makes that magic every day. Thanks for listening to this NPR station.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from C3 IoT, providing a software platform that brings machine learning, big data, and cloud computing to industrial-scale predictive analytics and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.com. From Margot and John Ernst, supporting North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York, and NPR's environmental coverage, which helps to raise awareness on issues surrounding climate change. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Xfinity On Demand, offering multi-screen, simultaneous viewing and access to live or on-demand TV from anywhere, on any device. More at Xfinity.com. The Lauren Hollerin Team, Gibson Sotheby's International Realty, helping people buy and sell real estate in Cambridge and Somerville for over a decade, laurenhollerin.com. And Medallion Gallery, announcing the store closing June 30th, hand-woven new and antique rugs in a variety of sizes and designs, available now. More at medalliongallery.com.
Was Tamerlan Tsarnaev a federal informant?
The families of those killed so senselessly deserve answers.
Tomorrow night, a Radio Boston investigation.
Any Muslim that the government had some leverage over could be coerced into becoming an informant.
A special hour, irreparable damage, unanswered questions in the Boston Marathon bombing.
I see a huge problem with the government not being more forthcoming, and I think the FBI is its own worst enemy.
Tomorrow night at 7 on 90.9 WBUR.
From Boston University, this is 90.9 WBUR Boston, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, and 89.1 WBUH Brewster. Online at WBUR.org and the new WBUR Listen app for iPhone and Android. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.